Today I'm in Melbourne and I'm speaking with author Romy Ash, particularly about her recent book, Floundering. Hello, Romy. Thanks for having me at your place.
Hello. Thanks for coming.
Now, Floundering, to me, it's in some ways quite a small book, but by the same token, for me anyway, it went very deeply and it was sort of one of those books that lingers. The issues that it deals with, they stayed with me for a long, long time. And I was interested, I suppose, particularly recently I've read sort of quite a few novels with the neglected children theme. There was Tony Birch's Blood, Past the Shallows, which had sort of aspects of that, an American book by Russell Banks called Lost Memory of Skin. I wonder why there's this sort of preoccupation at the moment with neglected children. Do you have any ideas on that?
I'm just reading Tony Birch's book at the moment, and I was surprised at how similar our themes seem to be. So I guess I can only speak for myself. Mm. So why am I interested in that sort of thing? I guess I didn't really come at it from the angle of the neglected child. I came at it more from just wanting to explore the perspective of a child.
Yes.
And, yeah, I guess as an author I've placed these children in a time of conflict and peril.
Mm. So what was the attraction to you for the child's voice? Where do you think that came from?
Well, I just really love playing with it as a writer. So, this lovely tension between what the reader understands and what the character is kind of experiencing and not understanding. Mm. And as well because we have two brothers in the book, we have the older brother and the book is told from the perspective of the younger child. So I think the book would be a very different book if it was told from Geordie's perspective, older child.
Yes.
So you really do get a vision of this child before these effects before everything's kind of happened.
Yes. I want to ask you particularly about that point of view and in a moment, but I noticed you had a short story called The Grey River Rest Stop, I think was published in 2008, which was about a Tom and Geordie and living in a caravan park. Was that, which came first?
The short story came first, which was published in the big issue in one of the fiction editions.
Yes.
And often my longer works kind of have their genesis in a short story.
Short story.
So,
how did you know that it was going to turn into a novel or from a short story?
Oh, when I couldn't stop writing. So, yeah, I just, I was really interested in that interaction between the siblings.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I just took them further.
Further, yeah.
Yeah.
So that point of view that you're talking about, Tom's point of view, Tom is the younger of the two boys, it occurred to me that as a writer, there must be a great challenge in getting inside the head of an 11-year-old boy and not being, how can I put it, the writer being themselves inside the head of the boy. Do you know what I mean? I mean, making that separation, I mean, how to be truly an authentic voice of an 11-year-old boy.
Yeah.
How was that?
Well, I don't think in the first draft I would have been an authentic voice of an 11-year-old boy. And it took a hell of a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I drew a lot on my own childhood experiences and memories. I guess not in the... not that I was neglected.
No.
But that I experienced the world through those childhood eyes.
Mm.
I definitely hung out with a heap of boys when I was a child. I was a tomboy.
Mm.
And my valley where I lived, which is kind of out the back of Byron Bay, we had this, there were so many boys and there just didn't seem to be any girls in my age group. So I feel like I know 11-year-old boys pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So why Tom, you said earlier, you know, if the story would have been different, it had been told through Geordie's voice, the older brother. Why do you think you chose Tom, the younger brother? Because for a writer, that must be so important, getting the right narrator.
Yeah.
So why Tom?
I think in the first draft, I actually did choose Geordie as the narrator. And I think the reasons that I swapped that around, I think because it's quite a harsh story. Like, what's actually happening is terrifying Indeed. And dangerous for these children. And it, I don't know, it maybe would have been too brutal to see it from Geordie's perspective. So we get this kind of sweetness through Tom's eyes. And I think for the balance of the book, that sweetness is really important. Mm.
There's a distance, isn't there, between for the reader, between what actually happened or what might have happened. So we're protected a little bit as the reader.
Yeah, definitely, because Tom doesn't know what's going on.
No, no, so we're not quite sure either. Yeah. Which I think I was going to say in a little while something about that tension. But just a little bit more about Tom as the younger brother. He's a younger brother, but in some ways he seems more knowing, more reliable perhaps. He seems to have a great connection with the landscape. He's perhaps a greater sensitivity. He's very polite, presumably from living with his grandparents. He seems a bit more knowing, would that be? Whereas Geordie, the older brother's perhaps a bit more reckless or doesn't know what he's getting into.
Yeah. Well, maybe I think because often, like, your main character by kind of necessity has to be the one that's the quiet one or the observing one. So he's definitely, I don't know, feeling things really deeply.
Yes.
And yeah, we're not given the chance to kind of figure out whether Geordie's like that as well. But obviously Geordie's kind of stepped into that realm of the teenager. So he might care about stuff, but maybe he's not willing to let on that he does. So he's kind of got more barriers.
Yes. You talked about the authenticity of that 11-year-old voice, and I can't remember really what it's like to be an 11-year-old boy. But I was noted, you know, that that comes through very strongly sometimes. There was one example on page 135 where he talked about the hard inside the tree. It's like he didn't quite have the word. He hasn't yet got the vocabulary to describe everything. So he's that voice comes through very much with that sort of limited vocabulary.
Yeah.
It's more about a tactile thing. He knows about tactile things, but he hasn't quite got the word.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that come naturally, or was that something you had to really work at?
I guess, I mean, sometimes I think it does come naturally, but I definitely did a lot of work with my editor, Kara Cooper. And we really did look at the manuscript kind of word by word. And we looked at it word by word with the 11-year-old boy in our mind. Like, would a 11-year-old boy say this?
Yes.
And, yeah, we pulled out anything that we thought was too sophisticated or... yeah, how he describes things is really coloured by his perspective. I think he describes a fart of a cloud one point. Yes. So definitely the 11-year-old boy coming through there.
Yeah. You make the editing process sound quite painful, though. Was it was it that painful?
Word by word.
Yes. Like pulling teeth.
No, it was great fun. I learned, obviously this is my first book, so I learned so much through this, that editing process. But I think maybe there's an idea that, yeah, writing a book is an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. No. And, yeah, things do get looked at that closely.
You said something earlier about what the reader knows and what perhaps Tom knows, that sort of tension. There's a real tension there about what might happen or what might have happened. There's withheld information. There's that sort of sense of threat is quite subtle. There are hints rather than explicitness. I mean, was that something that you really tried to attention in the book that you really had to work at as well?
Yeah.
So I think it's very effective. You know, if we knew everything, if we knew blow by blow, and we're really not quite sure what happened with Nev, but, you know, we know there's something, you know, looming in the background there. Was that a deliberate sort of choice to try and build that sort of tension?
Definitely, because I guess if you knew everything, it might be a boring book, you know, because the book relies so heavily on The Voice.
Yes.
Because not that much actually happens, and it occurs over such a very short period of time.
Mm.
And yeah, I really wanted it to be kind of filled with this kind of building horror or building tension,
mm.
where you, the reader, is kind of going, I know what's going on, and I'm worried, and what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Tom, the character, is like not sure of exactly what's going on.
Mm. It's a real sort of wonderful thing to achieve, I think, that sort of implicitness rather than explicitness, you know, adds a lot more and made the book sort of linger much longer, you know, after I'd finished reading, because there was mystery still about it. You know, everything wasn't spelled out or tied up, you know, neatly.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and at the end, maybe you don't know, you know, are they going to be okay?
Yes, you still don't quite know.
My dad is desperate for a sequel, and I would say, no.
Leave them there.
Leave them there, yeah.
Now, there were some style choices that I noticed too, that one particular that I was interested in where the direct speech that you use doesn't have inverted commas, and I wondered why. Well, I have got my own sort of reasons why you might have done that, but why was that a deliberate choice as well?
Yes.
Was that to achieve something in particular?
I guess it's it's kind of about flow, and I'm hoping that it's still obvious who's speaking where and when. Mm. But yeah, and because everything happens really quickly in the book. And I don't know, I kind of like this kind of, sentences running into one another.
Everything jams up together, yeah. I interpret it as a sort of a stream of consciousness sort of thing, which fits the point of view of the narrator.
Yeah,
and the events as well, that sort of everything pushing up against one another and happening very quickly, like you say.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think that works well.
Yes, indeed. The other thing I was interested in was the choice of time. These events happen over Christmas and New Year. Was that a deliberate choice too?
Yes.
Mm.
It's such an intense time.
lots of things happen with families.
Yeah, lots of things happen with families. People turn up who you didn't expect, or people don't turn up who you didn't expect, you know? Yes,
yeah.
And also I think there's an eeriness with Christmas, you know. Like there's descriptions of decorations and Christmas trees, and especially when we're thinking about Australia and there's all these weird like fir trees and snow and I kind of wanted to I think it's a interesting time to set a book.
It all seems a bit it's that sort of family time, isn't it? But you're sort of saying something about this particular family too at the same time.
And I do think things get feverish at that time. It's so hot.
Yes.
And maybe in Victoria it's not always hot at Christmas time, but growing up in Northern New South Wales or Queensland, it was devastatingly hot always. Yeah. Mm. So I kind of wanted to capture that feverishness.
Yes. The other sort of element that interested me too was the fact that most of the story is set in caravan park, and I noticed you've written some other stories in caravan parks too. Some of your fiction pieces, and also a non-fiction piece called Milk Bottle Rolling Pins, set in a caravan park. What is it about caravan parks as a setting that interested you?
Well, I've travelled a great deal around Australia. I went on a trip, and I guess it was just me and the grey nomads, you know. And I just found these places so interesting that, like, people would just live in what is supposed to be a transient place. Mm. And all up and down the west coast of Australia, I found it really interesting, these people who had kind of ended up there. Why the decision to stay in this transient place?
Mm.
And I guess where the book is set more than the other pieces, it's not so much, I mean, a caravan park, it's kind of like a camp for hermits out in the wilderness that gets, during these 2 weeks of time, like holiday time, filled with families, camping. But then we'll settle down and be quite bleak and lonely and isolated again.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of a person decides that's where they want to live, the end of their days, sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. So more fiction coming up in caravan parks, do you think?
Maybe I'll give the caravan parks a break. Give them a rest.
I suppose I'm sort of wondering, this story is about relationships, really, about, you know, relationship between the brothers and the mother and other people. And a lot of your fiction seems to be about relationships. Some of your other fiction pieces between brothers and sisters, lovers, often set in a foreign culture and sort of connecting sometimes but not connecting. I mean, you wrote a lovely piece about beaching whales as well too, about, you know, the sort of connection between two people that's there and then it's sort of lost. Is that sort of something that really interests you too, that sort of connection, relationships at heart? Is that what your stories are about?
Yes. Those, the short stories you've kind of made reference to, they're kind of exploring this idea of the outsider as well.
Mm-hmm.
So people finding themselves in foreign environments, whether that be, you know, in Tasmania where whales are kind of beaching themselves, or I think the other two stories are set in Japan. So, these characters kind of throwing themselves up against these foreign environments and yet maybe finding a deeper connection or no connection at all.
Yes. I thought we perhaps might finish up today, perhaps just ask you to read a small part of Floundering for our listeners, if you would.
Okay. So most of the novel, the beginning of the novel occurs like a road trip. So this is them in the car. And it begins with Tom. "Shotgun," I say, and look triumphantly over at Geordie. "Nah," he says, "you've got to call it in the morning. I've got shotgun for the rest of the day." "I called it, Geordie," I say. "Nah, you've got to call it in the morning." "That's not fair. You said if I call it, I can have it." "Yeah, if you call it in the morning, you can have it. It's totally fair." I look around for Loretta. She's walking fast towards the car. "Get in the car," she says from still far away. "But Mum," Geordie won't let me have a go. The mum slits out of me, strange in my mouth. "Get in the car." She's wrenching on her door and then she's in the front seat. Geordie pushes me out of the way and gets shotgun fast. Loretta starts the engine. "Get in." I open the back door and have to jump in as she accelerates. I close the door, watching the tar blurring in the open bit before I can get it shut. I fumble for my seatbelt and click it in. Safe.
Great. Thank you very much, Romy. And thank you very much for being with us today. And we look forward to your writing in the future.
Thank you.